Jake Shepherd, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Howard. Reminds me of me in the radio trying to put in too much content, I suppose.
It's true. It's like you take everything and boom, put it into a song and let's see what happens.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sometimes less is more. That is absolutely the case. So we want to continue having this conversation that we started, and I absolutely love the idea of using different disciplines really to analyze things differently. And it's called, we've called this the Loser Think series. And today we want to focus on thinking like a scientist.
Yeah. So really the Loser Think is a book by Scott Adams, and it's really about avoiding like ineffective ways of thinking and trying to embrace productive alternatives. So exactly right. So we want to look at the various professions and we want to see, can we adopt those professions and their approaches as a way of trying to think more clearly. And I think, so you're right. So let's look at a scientist. I also want to try and see if we can look at an engineer as well and see if we can do both. But just if we start as a scientist, now the scientific way of seeing the world is actually fairly new. You know, if you look back, it's maybe like 500 years old, you know, from Sir Francis Bacon's time. But it's really hard to argue against the utility of the scientific method. Because like if you're looking at the benefits that science brought us like over the years, like from modern medicine to computers to instant communication across the globe, and it's almost as if it's almost magical in the sense that you're expecting like the world's great problems to be solved by the next scientific breakthrough. So it really has huge utility. But I want you to recognize the fact that it's thinking like a scientist is hardly a natural way of thinking.
And well, certainly respects, for more of us, for some of us.
I mean, it resonates with me, but in many ways, it's like you have to work against your natural way of thinking of seeing and experiencing the world. And one of the reasons is like human beings are like really good pattern matchers, and we seem to see patterns wherever we look, even when there aren't any. And the, you know, I remember the book by the author Nassim Taleb. He wrote a book called Fooled by Randomness, and that highlights how we are wired to see trends and meaning, even when objectively there's nothing there.
Well, that's actually so interesting you say that, because I'm sorry I'm interrupting you, but there was actually a recent study that I was reading over the last few days saying that it's this need to do so that actually are making us find answers, the wrong answers, during the COVID-19 crisis, because we're just not geared, our brains aren't wired to experience what we're experiencing. So what we do is we're filling in the gaps and finding explanations that aren't necessarily real.
Yeah, and I suppose conspiracy theories like fit into that as well. And really a scientist is trained not to be fooled by these like apparent patterns that appear. Like one example of that is like anecdotal evidence, you know, so imagine somebody comes up to you and punches you in the stomach and they're wearing a green hat. Now, all of a sudden, all green hat wearing people are suspicious, you know, and really, you know, in everyday life, people do realize that there's a difference between like anecdotal evidence and scientific evidence. So they're not going to automatically jump to that assumption. But the problem occurs when we get trapped in a media bubble, where the media, like they will curate a particular narrative. They've got a particular agenda.
Yes, yes.
And then you just begin to think that all people who wear green hats are dangerous. And that like does come to the fore. And like another example, that I remember quite clearly is that people really have this, I would say almost irrational fear. Many people are in irrational fear of flying, because like all of these plane crashes, they seem to, you know, they hear about all of these plane crashes in the news and they make the headlines. But we know scientifically speaking, traveling by car is far more dangerous. But because car crashes are so common, they never make the headlines. And therefore the only thing you hear about in the paper is about the plane crashes. So anecdotally, it seems as if planes are more dangerous than cars, but in reality, they're not. So that's one thing. It's just learn to, I suppose, anecdotal evidence you have to take with a very large dose of salt cellars. And then the next area is like, you know, scientists, they adopt an approach where they will actively try and disprove their theories. You know, human beings, we like to prove that we're right. But scientists actually take the opposite approach. They say, let's just prove it. And the reason being is that you actually can't ever prove a scientific theory right. All you can ever do is prove it wrong. And, you know, Karl Popper, you know, he famously founded the school of thought of critical rationalism, that he says that the only valid knowledge that you can have is knowledge that can be falsified. And if it can't be falsified, it's not science. You know, which is fascinating. And so how do we use that? So imagine I'm an investor, and I'm looking at potentially purchasing a company, and I'm trying to see all the fantastic things about the company and trying to see how, like, all its potential and its upside. So maybe I should actually ask myself, well, how can this company fail? What are the ways in which it can, like, really not succeed? Look at it from the other perspective. So I would then say, like, just in terms of us, what we need to do is, like, get into a habit of asking yourself, what happens if the opposite of what I think is actually what's true? So, like, I might have a suspicion that somebody's stealing from me. Mm. And therefore, like, I'm feeling in a particular way to the person, quite suspicious of the person. If I stop and ask myself the question, well, maybe what happens if actually the person never stole from me? Now, all of a sudden, I've got a lot more control how I feel about that person.
Right.
Because I've actually just taken the opposite stance. And that's something that we can take, you know, from a scientific way of thinking. And another area where I think scientists can teach us a lot of stuff is in, you know, if we often see like two phenomena and we see that they like match up. Like, you imagine like these two graphs and you superimpose one graph on top of the other and the peaks match up and the troughs map up. And then your natural inclination is to think that one of those things that are matching up is causing the other. And it's a natural thing to think, no? And the what we need to realize is sometimes there's a third variable that actually plays a role. So the first time I ever heard, it was a mantra, actually, it's a mantra that I like use now. Correlation does not imply causation. And it's a mantra that we should all learn and drum into our heads as hard as we can.
Let's explain what that means.
But correlation does not imply causation. So when I first heard this mantra, I didn't know what it meant. Mm. It's just like a whole bunch of words, actually. Yes. And then when I understood it, I realized, sure, but I can't believe how often I fall into this type of loser think. You know, you see things correlate, you think they're the same. So imagine you've got a guy, And he's tracking the incidents, like the increase and the decrease of shark attacks. And he happens to also see about, you know, tracking the beachfront ice cream sales at the same time. And he sees these two curves are in lockstep. You know, ice cream sales go up, shark attacks go up.
Oh, what a wonderful
ice cream
example.
Sales go down, yeah. Shark attacks go down.
Mm.
So he's starting to postulate, well, maybe sharks really like ice cream. And that's why they're attacking these people who've eaten all the ice cream. And it's ludicrous, actually, because there's a third factor involved. It's called the sun. When it's hot.
Yeah, people on the beach.
People like to swim.
Yeah, people on the beach. More people on the beach. More ice cream being sold. More people in the
exactly.
water. And therefore, a higher incident of shark attack.
It's a shark attack. So correlation doesn't imply causation. And we get trapped by this all the time. So a popular one, you know, where we do get trapped is – you know, how often do you hear how the STEM fields must be incredibly sexist because of how few women are in the same STEM fields? But then I could use the same naive logic and say how sexist the nursing field is because it's underrepresented by men. You know, so maybe there's a third factor at play. And that third factor is, what is it that people are interested in doing? And if we try and answer that question of what interests people, maybe that's the third factor that's actually at play and not sexism or anything else, you know, nefarious.
Mm.
And I remember being told by a recruiter, you know, cause I'm in the software industry and we hire a lot of software developers. And I remember being told by a recruiter once that the best programmers share a particular, you know, personality trait. They're all disagreeable. And therefore, she specifically looks for disagreeable people to send to us for interviews. And I laughed because I said to her, well, you know.
That's so funny.
It was very funny. And I said to her, you know, maybe there's a third factor at play. Maybe it's not that when you become disagreeable, that's when you're a good programmer. And the third factor that's at play, actually, is that programmers like working with things more than they like working with people. And if you actually think about that, so people who are agreeable tend to be people-centered. So, you know, they want others to like them, and they're therefore polite and they're compassionate. But other people, like programmers, are very much thing-centered. They don't really care if they're liked, so long as they get to play with the really cool toys.
Cool stuff, yeah.
And if you've, cool stuff. And if you've been around programmers, you know that's actually what drives them, playing with the cool stuff. And I can confirm that every single software developer I've ever met really loved their toys. But not all of them are disagreeable. And I had to explain this to the recruiter so she didn't continue sending us all these disagreeable people. And then, I want you to then see if we could actually explore a little bit about the engineer as well, if you've got time.
Yes, so we've got a few more minutes.
I'm happy to talk about anything,
Let's just look at the engineer. So how do you look at life? How do you use an engineer's perspective to assess a situation?
Sure. So really, I suppose if you think the core of science is really discovery, I would say the essence of engineering is creation. So an engineer is like almost like a practical version of a scientist. So he's interested in solving complex problems and fixing those problems. So I remember there was a famous animated movie called Robots, and the one line that just really resonated with me was "See a need, fill a need." And I think that's essentially what engineers are. It's about trying to solve these problems, and we don't really get stuck in the theory so much. We don't always think that as long as I can get the solution to work, I'm happy. I don't even really care so much why it works. It's interesting sometimes, but let's get it working. So what you find is that many people get fixated with the concept that, you know, the cause of the problem, you know, there's a cause of a problem, and therefore the solution must be to solve the cause of the problem. And a lot of people get fixated on that concept. So for example, like let's say biting nails. So what's causing the nail biting to happen? It's the person. The person who's got the nails are biting their nails. You know, it's not somebody else forcing them to bite their nails. So really the solution then must be teaching self-control. That must be the solution. Whereas an engineer would say, actually, well, why restrict ourselves to the person themselves? You know, why don't we, like, maybe we could use hypnosis. That's an interesting one. We could, like, put foul-tasting nail polish on people's nails. We can get them to wear gloves. We can cut their nails short. You know, I'm starting to think like Elon Musk is like, he's unveiled his neural link, where he's planting this chip inside the brain. So maybe actually neural link might be a solution to this. So in other words, an engineer just doesn't try and solve the problem just by looking at what caused the problem. It looks a lot broader. And another area where engineers really strong is realizing that, you know, there's a one variable illusion to problems. So many people think that there's one thing that's at the core of why something else is going wrong. And really we just need to control that one thing. And an engineer is taught, life's way more complex than that. There are lots of different variables and you can't ignore all the variables. You have to take them all actually into account. I mean, there are cases where one variable is good enough. Like my gas bar stops working. Chances are, change the gas bottle, everything's fine. You know, there's one variable.
Right.
But if I'm looking at like the normal scenario, like in the world around us, the world's way more complicated than that. So if you're looking at climate change,
but Jake, don't we have this, and this is something that I keep seeing is that we seem to have this terrible need for simplicity. And we need to reduce things down to a level of simplicity. We remove the complexity, and that's the world that I think is becoming more and more dangerous. That everything we look at through a very binary perspective. Donald Trump is all good or all bad. Biden is all good or all bad. Everything is all good or bad. We like not to look at the nuance and complexity in anything.
100%. And nuance is where that's where the that's where solving the problem is all in the nuance. It's all in the understanding that there's lots of different things at play. If I look at like climate change, the narrative's been warped to such an extent that people start believing, you know, that if you want to, there's like one lever, there's one little control knob on climate. If you can control CO2 levels in the atmosphere up and down, you can control weather. It's nonsense, or climate. It's nonsense. You can have they've got the biggest supercomputers in the world working with like hundreds and thousands and millions of data points and inputs to try and actually simulate climate, and they battle. So to think it's just one thing is silly. I mean, and also like if you think like happiness, oh no, if I just had enough money, I'd be happy. You know, that's not true. You know, because money helps to a point.
Right. And everything. Yeah. And that's the point, is that you need multiple factors. We do unfortunately need to leave it there. Jake Shepherd, very, very interesting conversation indeed. Jake is a founder and a director at Synthesis, which is